Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Gardening, oh, it's a real pleasure, isn't it? But sometimes we have problems with our plants. Nature doesn't always cooperate with us, and we get some drought and lots of stress on the plants. And when they're stressed, it's harder for them to fight off disease and pests. And we are really happy today to have a couple of great guests who know what they're talking about when it comes to plant disease. Brian Huddleston directs the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison in the Department of Plant Pathology. And Brian, great to have you back. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
And with me as well, Liz Freemuth, who has horticulturist for Walworth County at one point.
I was at one point, yep. Yeah. Delightful. Delightful job, delightful people, great place.
And now you have a new business called The Garden Hoe, and it's a concierge service, right?
It is, yep. I take a look at problems in people's yards, make them happy, make their plants healthy, life's good.
And make you happy, hopefully.
I hope so.
Well, I tell you what are the, what were the major diseases that we saw this summer?
I think aster yellows, everyone had that, no matter where you were in the state. We had a huge influx of leafhoppers early in the season, and they were carrying what's called a phytoplasma. It's a little bacterium-like organism that causes this disease, and the leafhoppers were carrying it quite high levels. And so a lot of people are having coneflowers that look very, very odd this year, very green, leafy flowers.
Yeah.
And that's typical of that disease. We also saw a lot of tar spot this year, which is a disease on maples.
Which is just, I absolutely
everywhere.
Love tar spot. And
it's what I call an easy money disease, because mm-hmm. I can just look at it, say it's tar spot, and then I get to charge $20 to folks for doing that. So I like those sorts of samples.
It's a lot of that.
And typically I've seen that historically along the shore, counties that are along Lake Michigan, and now it's moving more towards the center of the state, and I've even seen people reporting it up in the Eau Claire area and towards the north as well.
Yeah. We've had it out in our area for quite some time, and it pops up here and there.
Mm-hmm. But I have lot of it in my yard because I didn't do fall cleanup last year and didn't get out this spring to do it either, so my maples are plastered.
Do as I say, not as I do.
Yeah,
pretty much
about it. Yeah, that's about it.
Shoemaker's kids, never shoes, the whole thing.
Well, Kim in Kenosha has a question that I think goes along with what we've been talking about here. Hi, Kim. Let's see.
Yes, I have. Maybe it is tar spot on our sugar maples, mm-hmm. and if that's what it is, they're about dime-sized black spots. Yeah. What can we do?
Yeah,
do they look like a, if you kind of let the light hit them from the side, it looks like a fingerprint on the surface?
I think they're more like a spot. Now, I have to go out and double-check.
Yeah, it's most likely tar spot. There are a couple of different species of the fungus mm-hmm. that cause it. The one that Liz is talking about is... let's see, it's Rotisma americanum,
it's the
I
cool one.
Yeah, that's the one that looks like a fingerprint in tar. Mm-hmm. The one you're most likely seeing is Rotisma acerinum, which is the one that we've seen more this year, where you get the black spots, but they're more diffuse. I kind of call them, it's like a George Seurat painting with all the little dots, mm-hmm. because the fungus forms mm-hmm. a whole bunch of little black dots, mm-hmm. and it's about dime or quarter size by the time you're done.
Right.
This is what I call do not panic disease. The best thing you can do is basically get out this fall, do really good cleanup, and make sure you get rid of all of those leaves that are infected, or as many of them as you possibly can. You want to reduce the potential for spore production next year, and that fungus is going to survive in that leaf litter over the winter. So if you can get that out
get rid of it,
I would take it. If you've got a municipal compost place, I would take it there. Mm-hmm. Other options, if you have the option, not real environmentally friendly, but if you have the option to burn, that would certainly be something you could do. You can bury the material as long as you're deep burying it. But I think if you've got somebody who can do real good hot composting for you, that's a good way to get rid of that material.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Appreciate your call. And Emma in Glendale. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm calling about my zucchini. The beetles killed that, and now they're working on my acorn. Is there anything I can do this year, or what should I do for next year?
Boy, that's kind of outside my realm of expertise. That's a Phil Pelletieri question, unfortunately. Yeah. But we do, I'm assuming it's probably squash bug.
And I would suspect.
In which case, we do have a fact sheet. Are you hooked up to the internet?
No.
Okay.
Have you seen the critter that's causing the damage?
Yes.
Okay, what does it look like?
Well, it's just, but there are many, many bugs crawling all over the place.
Yeah, I would say check the fact sheet because that's going to have a good picture on it.
What county are you in?
What county?
What county,
Milwaukee County.
I'm sorry, say that again, please.
Milwaukee County.
I would give the Milwaukee County UW Extension office a call. They should be able to get you a copy of that fact sheet. There's one on squash bug, and I suspect that's what you're dealing with. You could even collect up some of the insects and take it into their office for identification, but it kind of sounds like that's what you're dealing with at this point. And that fact sheet will have all kinds of information on control for you as well.
Probably not a lot you can do this year.
Not at this point, but definitely think ahead for next year.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, by the way, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. Love to see some photos too at my Facebook page. So go to the Larry Mueller Show. You can post some garden photos and also post some questions there as we visit with our plant disease experts, Brian Huddleston and Liz Freemuth, and Paula in Stanley, Wisconsin. It is your turn. Hi, Paula. Paula, are you there? We might have lost Paula. Well, yeah, let's try Ron. Ron in Sauk City. Hi, Ron.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Great. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, you just referenced the hot composting that takes care of the disease-producing organisms in leaves and such.
Yeah.
We have a very fine municipal composting system here in Sauk City. You know, they're huge piles, and they're progressive, and they stir them a lot, and you get the most beautiful compost out of them. But I'm wondering, do you believe... constitute the hot composting that would be required for like your black spot?
I'm expecting most likely yes, because they're most likely getting those piles to relatively high temperature. The other thing I do like to see is routine turning of the material, because what you need to do is get the material that's kind of cooler on the outside to the center of the pile. That's where you tend to get the higher temperatures. And I would just question them exactly their procedure and whether they monitor for temperatures. You want to get about 140 or so degrees.
Somewhere between 140 and 160. It varies a little bit, but if you're up in that 140 to 150 category, that'll take care of most stuff.
Yeah.
And that includes killing weed seeds also. Yeah, you want a little bit on the higher end if you're looking for weed seed death, but if they're monitoring and they're getting within that range, it should be fine. And again, like Brian said, with the turning, really very important, or else you're going to have that outer area that might not get up to temp to kill stuff.
Yeah, and it's really a combination from a disease standpoint of the temperature and the decay of the plant material that's really important. A lot of these disease-causing organisms really only survive in intact plant material. So once that is decayed away, these organisms don't survive particularly well.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thank you. Appreciate your call. And Camilla in Montello. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, sure.
What can we do?
I had heard the lady talk about her zucchini plants getting eaten, and I had that problem. I had thousands of them, and I didn't know what they were. I've never had these. They're the squash beetles. They're little silver bugs, and you'll get thousands of them on your plants, and they'll just totally kill your plants. And they moved down to my acorn squash, which was on the other side of my yard. I squished them all by hand.
Yeah.
Totally disgusting. It is.
Not
really.
Relatively satisfying, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
revenge treatments. Revenge treatments, as we call them.
If you're going to do that, oftentimes putting them into a bucket of soapy water will take care of it also. But it's just whatever level of satisfaction you achieve and how you achieve it is wonderful.
Yeah.
That's part of the fun of gardening, isn't it?
Well, one caution. Go ahead.
Get rid of them all. So.
One caution I would mention regarding if you are going to squash them is sometimes people have allergic reactions to certain insects.
Oh,
so
really?
you do have to be careful about that. So definitely be a little bit cautious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There you go. Thanks.
You're not using poisons and it works.
Yeah. Wonderful. Yeah.
Thanks, Camilla.
You bet.
Appreciate it very much. Thank you for calling. Well, it's amazing what you can do in even a half hour.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
You go out in your garden, you look at all those, I'll never get rid of all these. You start in a half hour later.
and
most of the time, or an hour later, you're done, and hey, they're gone.
And if you have small children, you can send them out to do it for
exactly.
You.
Well, and if you think about it, it would take you about that long to get your appropriate clothing on, yeah. get your chemical mixed up, get it out there, spray it. You could have had it done already.
Yeah.
Jeff in Galena, Illinois. Hi, Jeff.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got 7 or 8 smooth tooth aspens, the Populus tremuloides, I think. And we watered them through the summer, obviously. They've been in about 2 years now. They're maybe 8 to 10 feet high. And they, first one of the trees and then all of the trees, and developed, the leaves got white a little bit. It's not powdery mildew kind of white, but it's they're kind of crispy. They're kind of, just some of the chlorophyll's gone out of them, and they really stopped growing would be sort of another symptom. Just wondering what that might be and what I might do about it.
I think it's most likely probably our dry weather this year, quite frankly, and these are would be in a category of what I would consider new transplants, even though they've been in the ground 2 years. I usually think things have been in the ground 2 to 3 years are still new, and you need to really up the water a little bit on those. Mm-hmm. I normally recommend about 1.5 inches, maybe 2 inches of water for new transplants like that. And how are you watering?
About that, soaking them well once a week.
Were you using a soaker hose or just a regular hose, or how were you doing applying
regular
the water?
A regular hose.
I would invest in a soaker hose. This is something I recommend to pretty much everyone. They are not incredibly expensive, and for, $10 to $20, you can get 50, 100 feet of soaker hose, and I would place that out near the drip line of the tree and water there. And then what I usually recommend is if you've got an old tuna can or something of that sort, sink it into the ground so that the lip is level with the soil line. Place a section of that hose, soaker hose, over the can and just allow it to collect water until you get about 1 inch to 2 inches of water in the can. And that gives you an estimate of how much water you've applied.
And for new transplants, you really have to go even beyond just one ring of soaker hose. So you'll want to move that around a bit because with the soil so dry. And even now, you go into the ground 2 feet, and it is powder. It is absolute powder. That you really need to increase the amount, the area that hose has to get moist, in order to keep some moisture around those roots, in order for them to take up what they need to take up. Yeah. So it's
They were mulched, and I checked the soil. It really appears to be a disease-like situation. I don't know.
It doesn't sound like
a typical disease symptom that I would expect. But if you're concerned, you could certainly send in a sample to my clinic, and we could take a look to see whether we can find anything. What you need to keep in mind when trees are transplanted, particularly if they were grown in the ground and then dug up, they're cutting off a fairly large proportion of the root system to get those bald and burlapped to get them to your yard for transplanting. So the trees are coming in with a compromised root system to begin with.
Well, the nice thing is, though, that the fact that you watered this year is phenomenal.
Yeah,
that's going to keep them into next year, and you just need to continue to do that. I would send a sample into Brian to double check, because what we hear might not be what we would see, if we would look at it. So definitely send a sample to him to make sure that it isn't something else. But the fact that you're watering, continue to do that until hard freeze, and you will be surprised at how those things come back. And I would even go out and take a look at the branches and just do a scratch test on them to see if you've got green tissue towards the end. You'll be able to see now whether those buds are starting to plump for going into winter for next year's leaves. And if you're seeing that, don't worry so much about what's happening with the leaves, as long as it appears as though the tree is uptaking moisture and nutrients. Mm-hmm. And unless a tree re-leafs this year, like right now, don't fertilize until after we've got a couple of hard frosts that have hit. Otherwise, you're going to spur new growth. It's not going to make it. It's not going to harden off, in theory, before winter hits. In my yard, I've got trees that leafed out for the second and some of them third time. They get a little bit of fertilizer. They get a fast-release fertilizer right now because they're looking a little pathetic. But that's very controlled, and it's very minimal, and it's just to get them pumped up so they can make it through winter and into spring.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Brian, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at UW-Madison, and Liz Freemoth, who is owner of the Garden Hole, providing concierge horticultural service across Wisconsin and other parts.
Parts beyond.
Oh, my goodness. Chris Molina, our on-air producer, here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking about identifying and treating and preventing plant diseases today. On this edition of Garden Talk, I'm Larry Mueller with Brian Huddleston of the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology, Liz Fremoth, owner of the Garden Hole. Great to have them along. Thank you for listening. Call us at 1-800-642-1234 or go to my Facebook page. You can post a photo or a question there at the Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And Paula and Stanley, it's your turn. Thank you for calling.
And thank you for taking my call. The question I have is regarding some cannas, which we've grown for years, are very hardy, very reliable, these bulbs. This year we put them in the ground, haven't done anything different than we have in the past, and they came up, they've got to be like 18 inches, 2 feet tall, and the leaves just started shriveling, went brown, died completely back. And I'm wondering if this is something like what's going on with this viral thing with the leaf hoppers or what might be going on.
Yeah, with dieback like that, it makes me think that there might be something going wrong in the underground, mm-hmm. in the root system. Were you watering these on a regular basis?
Yes, we were.
Okay. Yeah, but, you know, one thing that can cause a lot of browning is drought, of course, so mm-hmm. if you're not watering enough, but I assumed you probably were watering them, and then I worry about some sort of infection. There could even be insect activity underground as well. Have you dug up any of the plants to look at the roots?
No, actually, we haven't.
That would be something that I would do, and just take a look to see whether you see any indication of decay, you know, mushy sort of material in the rhizomes, underground portions of the plant and the root system, just to see if there's any sort of infection there. If you are seeing that, that's unfortunately, I would get rid of those and then buy new ones and then probably plant in a different location next year. The only other disease that I'm aware of that I've seen on cannas has been, there is a viral disease, but that I wouldn't really expect the leaves to really shrivel up and die. You basically get distorted looking leaves and kind of a blotchy color to the leaves. But, you know, that sort of dieback is typical of something going wrong in the root system.
Okay, which could be viral or an insect.
I don't think it would be not viral per se, mm-hmm. but there are fungi that I would worry about that could be in the soil that could be infecting the roots and causing a decay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
All right, we'll dig them up. We'll see what we can find.
Okay.
All right, thanks
Sounds
a lot
good.
For calling. Appreciate your call. A Facebook question from Kathy, who has downy mildew on impatiens.
Ooh.
Mine went from beautiful to dead in a week. If I don't plant any next year, will I be okay in 2014? Anything I can put in planters in the shade that will be as colorful?
Yeah, definitely is. And where's this person from, if I may ask?
She doesn't say.
It's lovely if this person were from Wisconsin and she still has plants. I would love to see a sample. We'll actually do this one free of charge because we have yet to confirm this disease this year in Wisconsin. So feel free, if you're from Wisconsin, to send me a sample. I have seen the disease. We had a sample from Northern Illinois come in. And how she describes it is perfect. The plants all of a sudden just lose all of their leaves. And they look pretty much dead. The stems will still be green, but pretty much takes
all
the
foliage. What would she have to send? Just some of the
Just send some of the leaves and branches in. And
and where would she send?
Send it to the Plant Disease Diagnostics Clinic. Actually, I'll give you my website that has information on how to send samples in. That's pddc.wisc.edu. And definitely there's a submission section in that website, and you can just click on that, and it gives instructions on how to package up materials and get it to my clinic. In terms of the question that she actually asked, I would suggest, don't plant impatiens. Make sure you really, really clean up really well this year. I would not expect this organism to survive particularly well over the winter, but it is good to clean up the material. I would just bag it up. This is not something I would necessarily compost. I would double bag it, stick the garbage bags that you have the material in out in the sun to cook. These particular organisms, the downy mildews, are obligate parasites, which means they really don't survive outside of plant tissue. There are some exceptions to that, but I think cooking the material will do a good job to get rid of it. Don't compost the material. Put it in your normal garbage and then stay away from impatiens for a year or so. And then what do you suggest for replacements? Coleus or something like that?
Yeah, you know, there's nothing that's going to give you the same color that impatiens does. But coleus, anything with leaves, and you can even go to the tropical plants. If this is something that you're doing for summer specifically and you're going to plant annuals, you could go to some of the very, very colorful tropical plants, which will take duller light and still have those gorgeous oranges, reds. And you know, if you're looking for a bright pink, though, there's nothing that does it for the shade, just like impatiens do. But don't put them in again. Yeah. And in New Guineas, are you seeing them? Will those get hit as well?
My understanding is it's not as serious a problem on New Guineas, but it's the more typical impatiens that where we see this, the common impatiens.
Mm-hmm. And I haven't, the reason I ask is I haven't seen anything out there on New Guineas getting that. Mm-hmm. And if that's not the case, and if you want to give it a whirl, some of the New Guineas are tremendously bright in leaf color and also in flower color. So you may not get the exact same look that you've got. And some of the New Guineas will actually get to be about thigh high if they're happy. So they will get quite a bit bigger than what some of the regular impatiens will
do. I would still recommend not planting in exactly the same area where you had your regular impatiens mm-hmm. this year, just to be on the safe side. And I should mention, I've seen tons and tons of downy mildews. It's not only impatiens downy mildew. There are lots of downy mildew organisms out there. I want to call it a fungus, but it's not technically one. But there are a lot of these organisms out there. I've seen downy mildews on more hosts, more different plants this year than I have ever seen in the clinic. So they are out there.
We have more callers on the line here, and we're going to go to Michelle in Fond du Lac next. Larry Mueller here with my guest plant disease experts, Brian Huddleston and Liz Freemuth. And Michelle in Fond du Lac, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thank you so much. I love your show, and it's perfect timing that these two are on. I have actually worked at a greenhouse since 1994 and pretty much have given the same advice that you did. I have a problem with the silker host situation on new shrubbery around my home. I have mulched this year with hardwood versus cedar mulch. And what happened was, did the silker host water thoroughly, did the same thing I would tell any of my customers, but what happened is I left the silker host on and went away for the weekend, and so it just drenched the entire area.
We're kind of chuckling because we've all been there. Yep.
Right. Okay, so now because I used hardwood, of course we had a sale at the greenhouse, and I didn't use cedar mulch, I am getting a fungus that I can't identify. It is not sulfur shelf. What happens is that in the first stage it starts off and looks like a foamy yellow spattering, almost like, sorry to be, you know, disgusting, but baby throw up all over.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And then it hardens up and it looks like spray insulation. And then after that, it starts to fade and firm to a light beige with a tan crust.
Uh-huh.
And then if you tap it on the inside, it's like a dark brown.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then the spores fly everywhere. I have mold out.
You are a good descriptor.
That is fantastic.
Yeah, you could have stopped at the foamy stuff at the beginning. In fact, you didn't even need to describe. I saw the description on the monitor here, and I was pretty sure I knew what you were dealing with. This really isn't a fungus. It's what's called a slime mold. And I like your comment or description that was like baby vomit, because we affectionately call this one dog vomit slime mold.
Nice.
Yeah. And we see it a lot on newly spread hardwood mulch. And the main thing is just to be patient. It will, once the mulch ages for a little bit, it tends to go away. But the moisture that you provided was a great environment for it to develop.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was a good science experiment.
It was a wonderful lab, outside lab, yep.
And slime molds are really cool. We saw one. I had a picture come through one of my diagnostic listservs this morning that where the little fruiting bodies microscopically look like little spherical bird cages. So I think slime molds are really, really cool. This one does freak people out. If you want a real hoot, do a web search sometime on Texas slime mold and 1970s, because there was a lot of this apparently that popped up in the mid-1970s, and there's all this talk about alien invasions and that sort of thing. So it's really pretty amusing.
I don't think I've ever seen that one. Yeah.
But no, it's not anything to worry about. If it grosses you out when it pops up, my recommendation is just to take a shovel and pick it up and remove it, because that's all you really need to do.
And I put it in a plastic bag and a very hot garbage can and let it just bake the blazes out of it.
If you're lucky, you'll get more.
Yeah, well,
yeah, you could.
I love this stuff, quite frankly. Yeah. Quite frankly, if you have small children that need science projects, slime molds are a good thing that you can grow.
Oh, yeah, I'm a teacher, so they love coming over. So,
yep.
But my allergies aren't happy.
Understandable.
Thanks, Michelle.
Thank you. Have a great day.
Yep, you too. Appreciate your call. Lynn emailed us. She planted 2 honeysuckle vines this summer. Both have powdery mildew and leaf blight. She's been spraying fungicide to prevent spreading, but the plants are pretty covered in these 2 diseases. Should I cut them out now or prune them now, or should I wait until the first frost? And then how far back do you prune? If I prune them back to the base, should they grow back, or would they grow back disease-free in the spring?
You can hack and whack on honeysuckles to your heart's content for the most part. Right now we're at that in-between period that if you cut them back and we get a long, warm fall, you will see some growth. If we get a very intense freeze, you'll lose that new growth. But, you know, it's a toss-up. You really are going to have to clean up very, very well right now and then into fall as those leaves fall off. So, you know, personally, I would wait a little bit, but I would also go out there, because they're new plants, I would go and I would pick the diseased leaves off and then just let it go. At this point, powdery mildew, you know, if you hose it down, that's going to take care of at least a little bit, but the leaf blight is not. Exactly. So to me, it's like, you know what? They were new plants. If they're not, my rule in my yard and for some of my clients is that if it is not happy, it needs to go away. And personally, I would say cut it off. If you want to do a little bit on the iffy side, wait until we get a hard freeze. Then you can trim them back and you can take them back to about a third of the height that they're at right now safely. Honeysuckle, you could probably cut it back to the ground level as long as it doesn't have real woody stems, and you'd be okay. If it's a single stem coming up out of the ground with a couple of major branches coming off, you'll want to cut above those slight branching off vines. Otherwise, go ahead, hack and whack.
Yeah, I think you're going to see powdery mildew every year on viney honeysuckles. I tend to see a lot of on that particular host. So I think you're going to have to learn to either be tolerant of that or really thin the vines so that there isn't a lot of overlap. You want to get good airflow so that you don't have a lot of humid air around the leaves. That's what environmentally tends to drive powdery mildews. So the other thing is there are some spray treatments if you want to go that route. There is actually a baking soda and horticultural oil mix that you can use as a preventative treatment. But again, all of these are preventative treatments. If you get it on after you see symptoms, it's too late. And if you're interested in the recipe for this, if you go to my website, which I gave out before, go into our publication section and go into virtually any of the sections, and you're going to find in where we have our fact sheets, and we have several fact sheets on powdery mildews, and you should be able to find the recipe in those fact sheets.
Yeah, just the last thing I would say is that if they're not happy where they're at, this was a tough year, but if they're not happy, dig them up and try them someplace else. This is a good time of the year to do that, someplace with a little more airflow.
And again, what's your website again?
It's pddc.wisc.edu.
And let's turn to Warren in Minocqua. Hi, Warren.
Hi. I have a particular problem with an oak. It's a mature oak. I'd say it's 35 feet tall.
Okay.
And what's happened, each year the leaves are off the bottom branches, and each year it goes higher, and I have maybe, I'd say, a quarter of the lower branches defoliated right now, and the top of the tree is beautiful. The leaves are green, and everything is perfect.
Do you know what kind of oak you have, sir?
No, I don't.
Are the leaves pointed? Kind of pointed? Or instead of being kind of roundish? Don't know for sure? Okay.
I don't know for sure.
Okay.
Yeah, my thought is one of the leaf diseases on an oak. There are several of these, and again, they tend to attack the leaves on the lower branches first because these organisms survive in leaf litter from last year that's on the ground, and the spores that are produced in that leaf litter will blow up to the lower leaves, and so it'll defoliate from the bottom up. And these are, in many ways, cosmetic diseases, although you really don't want a lot of defoliation year after year after year. So I think my major recommendation, not knowing exactly which disease it is, would be just really good fall cleanup. Any of the leaves that come off the tree, definitely get rid of those. If you're a composter, you can certainly hot compost them. But again, I would get them away from your trees so you don't have a real...
So you wouldn't run a mulching mower over
Definitely those. Not, because those little bits of leaf are still going to harbor these fungi.
And then can I ask, do you use any kind of broadleaf weed treatment?
No.
Okay.
This tree is growing along my driveway, and it's in the woods.
Okay.
Okay.
And just double checking.
And again, if you've got it in the wood in a wood setting, it's going to be very difficult to get
to
rid of the,
yep.
the leaf litter. And so you may just have to become somewhat tolerant of it defoliating a little bit on those lower branches. I would not recommend any sort of spray treatment for this. I don't think it's warranted, and I think it would be very difficult, even if you wanted to do that, to get good coverage. So I think as much of that leaf cleanup as you can do, that would be great. It's not a lethal disease that we're dealing with here. So I think the tree will survive quite nicely with this loss of the leaves.
And thank you for calling. Appreciate it. And Holly in Sockville. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Okay, so I have a never-ending problem with my shrub roses. And I know it's been a bad year, but they're supposed to be a, disease resistant. It's called a nearly wild shrub rose.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I've got a lot of the plants. I mean, they're grouped, and I probably have a dozen of them. And, of course, I've been dealing with the, the powdery mildew and the rust spots and all this other stuff that I've been spraying. And I'm wondering... Well, I got two things. I've got them mulched, and I know you're supposed to get rid of the dropped leaves, but since they're shrub roses, it's like it's so hard to get into there.
Yeah.
And with the mulch, should I just remove the mulch and everything to get rid of the leaves? I mean, I don't know how to get in there.
Let me ask you this. When you're treating it, nearly wild, you shouldn't have to treat on a yearly basis. It really should be every once in a while when the pressures are tremendous. Then you'll get a year where, you probably should have treated. But if you don't start treating before the leaves pop open, you're kind of behind the eight ball on that already, and you're treating to make yourself feel good. So if you don't catch them early in the season, it is going to be a forever problem. And, you know, as Brian had said earlier, you can't really get rid of it once it's there. You know, you have to prevent it from infecting the tissue. Uh-huh. And so you have to start before the leaves pop open.
Oh, I'm starting too late. I'm looking at them when they pop open. Hey, they look great this year. And then all of a sudden they turn into.
Yeah, and for something like that, I would say you might even be able to get a step up if you're out there before those leaves pop out, get some treatment on, and the baking soda will probably work for this. I would almost go with a fungicide myself with something else in it early in the season.
It sounds like you're dealing with more than just powdery mildew.
Are you
seeing black spots on the leaves as well?
Yeah, they're like the rusty spots.
So they're orange.
So you've got rust too.
Is it really bright orange and
Then let me ask you this: do you really like them?
Yeah. How emotionally attached are you to these roses?
Well, I'm financially attached.
Okay.
Well, because the landscaper put them in, and like I said, I've got probably about a dozen of them.
Mm-hmm.
And
okay, do you thin them out at all?
Well, this year I did not,
because it got away from me.
But I have so much dead wood on there that I did thin them out just within the past week or so.
Okay, a couple of things you need to do during the dormant season. That's gear up for a treatment and take a look. Brian's got a good fact sheet. There is a good fact sheet out there on rose diseases. You've got one.
It's just an ID sheet. So we do have one on powdery mildew. We have
one on
blacks. On
rust.
On blacks.
And
we don't have one
on
rust.
Okay.
Yeah. The problem problem with the rust and the black spot is that those two fungi can actually infect the canes. So you're going to have to inspect the canes for spotting, and you're going to have to prune those out.
Yeah, and that's those are the two, the, actually three things. You need to get treatment started early. You need to get those things pruned out and do that as an up-close, not a hedge trimmer. You need to get up-close and personal with the pruners, and you need to get debris cleaned up from underneath. And if you can do that, then you're going to at least be able to see what they would look like with cultural care early in the season, and then you're going to have to make a decision. Do I really love these, or is it time to look at something else?
Because, yes, you've made a huge investment in terms of the shrubs, but now what you're talking about is a huge investment in terms of time and potentially in terms of chemicals. Do you want to continually have to do that?
Yeah, there you go. So good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Holly. Talking plant diseases today, focusing on that with Brian Huddleston of the UW Department of Plant Pathology and Liz Freemuth, who owns The Garden Hoe, providing concierge horticultural services. Larry Mueller here. And join in with a question at 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Roxanne next in Frederick. Hi, Roxanne.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, this kind of crosses into Phil's area of expertise as well. I had tent caterpillars, two little pockets of them on an old hop o' crab tree, probably about 50 years old, that probably isn't in real good shape anyway, and it pretty much decimated every leaf. So what between the combination of the worms and the probably apple scab, whatever, what are the chances of survival of this thing, and is there anything I can do over winter?
Honestly, I don't think I'd worry about it tremendously. What kind of tent caterpillars were they?
The itty-bitty ones.
They came early in the spring? Season? In the spring.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And did it re-leaf after that?
No.
And are you seeing any live tissue on the branches? Go out and do a scratch test. This is a fingernail scratch test, and you go up and down, and you see if you can break through that outer bark and see what color the tissue is underneath. And to me, that is a huge thing. Is this a tree that is really valuable for you? Does it have emotional attachment? You know, do you love it? Is it an eyesore? What is it?
No, not really. It's not really sentimental either. It's just it's always been there. I know that I'm.
Is this an
probably put a new one in?
Is it an odd year? Is it an odd year for it? Does it usually look pretty good?
It looks worse this year than it has others.
Okay,
of the leaf thing.
Yeah, do the scratch test on the branches to see if you've got some live tissue in there. And if you do, I would say just wait until after. You know, if you haven't seen re-leafing on it, the tree is not under any more tremendous stress than any other tree out there. Just make sure that you get water on it, and after we get a good couple of hard frosts, get some fertilizer on there so that in spring it will have something to draw on and get some nutrients in there, get it up to the leaves. I don't know as if I'd worry about it. If you clean the tent caterpillars out of there, you still may have some residuals if you can never get them all out. I find if I remove them even physically, some will show up again the next year. Get out there really early, get them out of there, and you should be okay. You know, I wouldn't worry about it tremendously. Just get water and nutrients on at the appropriate time.
If you see the tent caterpillars, as soon as you see any of the netting, get out there. And, you know, I know it's disgusting to reach in and grab that, wear a plastic glove or something, and just grab that webbing in the larvae and just stick that in some soapy water.
Yep.
And that's the best way to get rid of those.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking plant disease today with Brian Huddleston and Liz Freemuth. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for listening into this edition of Garden Talk as we visit with Brian Huddleston and Liz Freemuth about identifying, treating, and preventing plant diseases. Glad to have you listening in. And you can join us at 1-800-642-1234. If you've got a photo or a question, post it on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. I'd love to see those, too. Let's turn to Steve in Barneveld next. Steve, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my phone call. I was just wondering what your guests' thoughts were on using rubber mulch.
Is this shredded rubber?
Yeah. We bought them. It was a double shredded. It was a color. It had a brown color to it, but otherwise it was looks just like regular mulch.
Yeah, my main concern with that, are you using it on edible crops?
What's that?
Are you using it on vegetables or anything of that sort?
No. We put it around an evergreen tree and two other deciduous trees.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily any better or worse than other types of mulch. The main thing is that you want mulch to maintain a little bit of moisture, and I would think that that would help as well as any other kind of mulch. I would be a little cautious about using it around things that are producing parts that you want to eventually eat, just because of potential leachates that might be coming off of that might be toxic.
Yeah, I the only concern that I have with rubber mulches is when it goes to my technique of applying mulch, and that's put it down and then work it into the ground over the years and put new stuff down, that I'm not so sure that's something you want to be doing with a rubber mulch. That's more of a topical mulch where I would actually recommend that people put down some sort of weed barrier cloth so that you don't have that rubber mulch going into the ground. I don't know what the half-life is on rubber.
If you're talking about a barrier material, then that's problematic for me because what I've seen over and over again where people use these landscape fabrics is that it tends to retain too much moisture in the soil, and we start to have root rot problems on more susceptible types of plants.
Well, and not only that, but it also does collect an awful lot of debris between the mulch and that weed cloth. So there are some issues with it. But as far as anything else, I would think it would work just as good. I would just personally have to change how I use mulch. And if you're using it as a topical mulch, I can't see why it wouldn't work just fine, too.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks, Steve, for calling. Nancy in Houston, Bernie in Eagle, your turn. Hi, Bernie.
Hello, this is more about a cultural question.
Okay.
We received hydrangea paniculata, I forget the named variety, but it's with the cone-shaped fertile and non-fertile flowers. I know it's a beautiful plant. On the care tag, it says part sun or partial shade, and I've seen them used very well in exactly those conditions.
Mm-hmm.
We have only full sun where we would be able to see and enjoy the plant, and we have extremely well-drained soil, and I don't want to turn it into a work requirement trying to keep it well-watered. What is your experience with that plant?
It will be a little bit more open and will have a little bit more of an open structure in partial shade, but depending on which cultivar it is, they do beautifully in full sun for us this far north, as long as there is moisture somewhere in the soil.
That's my experience too, and I'm concerned with the weather we've been having that this will turn into a project for my 80-something mother.
Okay, so it's for your 80-something mother in her yard? How far away from the watering hose is this shrub planted?
It's not planted yet.
Okay.
And that's the thing. It's deciding the siting, and the only part shade places we have, she wouldn't be able to see it and enjoy it.
Yeah. If it's close by, that in times of extreme drought, you would need to augment the natural water. You're looking at the equivalent of 2 inches of rainwater per week. So if your 80-year-old mother wants to walk out and water one shrub that's not too far away, if she's physically able to do that, that probably you'd have to ask her, but that might be acceptable, especially if it's a plant with some meaning. But it does require moisture. Hydrangeas do require moisture. They are not particularly drought tolerant. They will tolerate some, but you will see smaller blooms. You will see some kind of misshapen and odd colored leaves on them if they don't get enough moisture. I would say, putting more moisture retentive soil around it is only going to create a container situation, and that's going to be temporary at best, and that's going to have some issues that go along with it. So I would say just put it in a spot where you can water it if you need to, and you should actually be okay. They've got them growing in full sun up at the up at the Test Garden in Madison, and they do just beautifully. So
there you go.
I wouldn't worry about it tremendously.
Another
quite
situation
honestly.
Where a soaker hose might be a good investment.
Yep. Thanks, Bernie, for calling. Appreciate your call. We had Julie, who has had trouble. This is a Facebook question. Had trouble in the past 2 years with a deep blue delphinium. Should I dig the plant out? It was beautiful. Then the leaves got dark, and the whole plant looks bad. This is Bayfield County.
Boy, that's hard to tell based on that description what might be growing on. What I do know, the thing that I think of when I think of delphiniums is not a disease problem, but there's a mite. It's either broad mite or cyclamen mite, one of the two that
seeing browning on the leaves, I would take a look at that first. And with the kind of heat, now up north they had more rain and less heat than we did. But
these types of mites, though, actually cause the leaves to really distort and get, it almost looks like an herbicide sort of issue. But that's my first thought.
I don't think I've seen those down here. Yeah.
Phil gets those in every once in a while. And so when I get to delphiniums, I take them to him first because it's usually his problem, not mine.
So what I would say is get a picture to Phil, quite honestly. Because if that's something he's dealt with before, he's the guy to go to for that one, definitely.
Nancy in Eustisford, hi.
I believe I did not get my garlic enough water this spring, and so I've got very small garlic. I was wondering if I should buy new garlic, or could I just plant the little cloves from the little bulbs, or should, and exactly when's a good time to plant that?
How long have you been using the same garlic, babies?
I just bought it last year.
Is this a cultivar that you've used in the past?
No.
Start fresh. If you've got bulbs, they should be okay. If you want to do a half and half and see how they do, you should be okay. You do need to make sure that they get watered in good later in the season, early in the spring. But if it isn't a cultivar that you've tried before, it might not actually perform well for you, so I would go out and get a different one and give it a try also. We did have very dry conditions over winter, dry fall, dry spring, the whole thing, so I would expect some smaller garlic. I would say use the garlic and try a little bit of it, then go buy some new stuff.
Mm-hmm. There you go. Thanks, Nancy. Liz Remuth and Brian Huddleston, disease experts answering your plant disease questions. Great to have you listening in today. Marion in Sauk City, we'll turn to you next. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Well, thanks. I didn't have to wait as long as I thought I would. But anyway, I noticed I do have some powdery mildew on some of my cucumber plants. Is there anything I could put in some water to water them, like a little bit of ivory soap or something like that? Would that be of help at all?
No. How much powdery mildew are you seeing?
It's not a lot.
Okay, at this point in the season, I would not be concerned, quite frankly. Okay. And are you feel like you're getting reasonable numbers of fruits off your plants?
I did today, yeah.
Yeah, then I would not be concerned, quite frankly. We're getting late enough in the season that I don't think I would worry about treating.
Mm-mm.
The things that you do for powdery mildew control would be try to open up the vines as much as possible to get good airflow. Sometimes with cucumbers, I'll recommend that people kind of trellis them so that
some of them are, but they don't always obey.
Yeah, where you want them to go. That's plants are so unpredictable in that way, aren't they?
That's the truth.
And then the other thing would be you may want to thin some vines if they get really thick. That will open up the airflow as well. If you really become desperate, if you have years or have had a history where the powdery mildew comes in really early to the point where leaves begin to totally dry up and turn brown, and that impacts the number of fruits that you're getting, then there is a baking soda and lightweight horticultural oil spray that you can use as a preventative treatment. And again, I mentioned that the recipe for this is in our powdery mildew fact sheet. And that's available at my website. Are you hooked up to the internet?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you go to my website again, pddc.wisc.edu, go into the publication section under vegetables and look for powdery mildew.
Okay.
And you will find the fact sheet, and it's got the recipe right there.
I just want to make one comment about the ivory soap, and I know a lot of home remedies will call for either dish soap, laundry soap, something like that. You have to be really, really careful when you're using those types of products because they're not making those for use on plants, and the oils that they use in their mixtures have to follow their specifications. They might be a little bit too heavy for the plants at certain times of the year, so buying something that's made for horticulture use is the best thing to do. So, you know, buy a horticultural soap or a horticultural oil that's appropriate for the temperature and the time of the year.
Okay, fine. And I have one more question.
All right.
About rhubarb. It really took a beating this year. I could not keep it all watered. Mm-hmm. And so it really looked bad for a long time. It's coming back somewhat. Is there something I could put on it this fall to give it a boost? And what kind of soil does it like? Do you know that answer?
Well, it likes a decent garden soil, and if it came back just fine, and actually I've got some clients that rhubarb is on its third cutting already, and, you know, we had that little bit of dormancy, and it's popping out again. Go into the garden center, and what I look for is I look for something that is specific to the plant that I am fertilizing. Yes, can I mix my own? You betcha. Yes, can I play around with it? You betcha. Do I? No. I go to the garden center and I buy for tomatoes, or I buy for stock crops of some sort, spring crops. Get something on in the fall after a couple hard frosts and get it into that area and you'll be fine. But regular good garden soil works just fine for rhubarb. It does like good drainage.
Okay, the other question is, does it like acidic or more base?
Grows fine around here. We've got it in sandy soil, regular garden soil, so I'm going to guess I don't know off the top of my head. I'm going to take a fairly educated guess and say it's in the middle of the range.
Okay, good. Thank you. Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Boy, lots of disease issues and lots of great plant questions here on Garden Talk. Brian Huddleston, one of our guests today, director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology, and Liz Freemuth, who was previously horticulturist for Walworth County, is now owner of The Garden Hole. She has a passion for healthy and happy plants. I'm Larry Mueller on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. If you're like me, you like to get your hands dirty once in a while in the garden, get some work out there with the plants. Some of them grow well pretty much no matter what. Others, are like a few of mine, are susceptible to wet pests and diseases. Larry Mueller here. Glad to have you along today on the Ideas Network. We're zeroing in on plant diseases today. Our guests, Liz Freemuth, who previously a horticulturist for Walworth County, owner of The Garden Hole. It's a concierge horticulture service. Liz, thanks for coming by today, by the way.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Tell me a little bit more about your service. We haven't talked about that much.
Well, concierge is a good description of it, because it really varies. It depends on what the client needs. And oftentimes that starts with diagnostics. I'll be brought in when things don't look real good and might need a little bit of help. I come in, do a review, send stuff to the lab if need be, get recommendations from Brian, you know, based on what I see, what he sees, then we can set up a treatment plan for them. And oftentimes that will morph into a long-term, actually all of them, morph into long-term relationships where it becomes a little bit of design, a little bit of plant recommendation. This year I even took on an ornamental vegetable garden for an historic house. And so then that becomes even a little bit more interesting. So
really, kind of fun too.
Absolutely. You know, and for me, it's every day if you can't get up and have a good day, then just go back to bed. It's got to be a good day. And then in my spare time, I sit on the board for a new botanic garden down in Walworth County that we've been working on. It's called Congdon Gardens, and it's in the little city of Delavan. And just starting to increase the growth, and there will be buildings going up. And yes, it's a fantastic little project. As we kindly refer to ourselves, we are a board of slaves. And so if I'm not with my clients, I can be found out in the gardens.
Wonderful. And Brian Huddleston of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, you see more disease in plants than anybody in the whole state of Wisconsin.
He happily sees disease.
Yeah, I really do get psyched by my job. And I have to say, we joke a lot about what we do because, you know, we are seeing dead and dying stuff. The plants that come into my lab are pretty depressing most of the time. But we do a lot of jokes and try to keep it fun. And we have a lot of actually folks in the lab this year doing kind of internships. So I've got graduate students visiting the lab, had a master gardener who's been coming in about once a week.
Wonderful.
And we go through samples and show them cool stuff that we're seeing. And it's a lot of fun.
Well, there's no shortage of questions here on lots of calls. Susie in Springfield, Illinois has been waiting a long time. So let's go to Susie. Hi, thank you for calling.
good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have kind of an entomology question. Hopefully you can answer it. The soil we have is mainly clay, and I have more ants than I think anywhere else on the planet. They're the tiny little black ants, and I've got one raised vegetable bed, a raised herb bed, and every time I water those, ants come out like crazy with their eggs. And then if I pull up a brick or if I have some little tchotchke in the yard, again, a plethora of ants. I actually put some water on my standing compost bin about 2 weeks ago, and I disturbed the mothership of all the ants. I swear there were, I seriously think there were probably 100,000 of them, because I could have scooped them up with my hand overflowing.
Mm.
And spiders fine, bees fine. I hate these little ants now. I'm just to the point. But I don't want to poison the soil. Mm-hmm. I know ants are good for the soil, but I've had so many nest around some plants that they've killed them.
Mm-hmm.
What do I do with these things? And I don't know why I'm ant central, but
yeah. Okay.
Well, what I would suggest you do is I don't know who's available at the University of Illinois. I know they have a plant disease diagnostic clinic there. I don't know if they do insect ID or not, but that at Urbana, I would check out the University of Illinois to see if they have an entomologist who can identify the ant for you. And you can probably get some baits to help get them under control.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes that's the best option for getting rid of ant colonies, because you want something that they can take back to the nest and feed to everyone that will poison the queen and everyone involved. So, and those are usually a little bit lower impact in terms of, rather than spraying or pouring materials onto a nest. So I think the first thing you need to do is find out exactly what sort of ant you're dealing with, because there are different types of ants like different types of baits. So you need to know which one you're dealing with to select the correct bait.
There you go. Thanks for calling. Sharon in Itzen, Minnesota. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning. Yes, I have 100 feet of raspberries, and I was washing one the other day, and I have all kinds, or let it sit in the water, and I have all kinds of little bitty white larvae in there.
Yeah, my concern with this one, we have had a new insect pest in our area and here in Wisconsin that just kind of exploded the last couple of weeks, called the spotted wing Drosophila, and it's been a problem in raspberries. So again, you're in Minnesota. I would check at the University of Minnesota to see if there's an entomologist there, particularly someone who deals with fruit crops, and see whether that might be what you're dealing with. This is a very, very destructive type of insect. And it's causing real problems in raspberries here in Wisconsin. I'm suspicious that that may be what you're dealing with there.
Good luck. Thank you for calling. And Joyce and Nina, on to you now. Hi, Joyce.
Hi. I appreciate the program. I have a magnolia tree, mm-hmm. and it bloomed this year fine. We've never seen what I saw on it later in the summer. For one thing, I noticed just a bunch of bees in the tree one time, and I looked up in it on the branches and saw what looked like sort of like little almost fungus on the branches, sort of like a cottony color, just all over the branches. And I made some calls to some landscape centers and was told it's probably magnolia scale.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And wondering if, okay, so it was probably there most of the summer. It bloomed fine in early April instead of early May, a month earlier, but it was healthy looking. But then this summer I noticed there's some dead branches on it, and I thought it was related mm-hmm. to the scales and stuff, so I got rid of the dead branches, and then someone told me to spray on this malathion, I think it's called, maybe it's pronounced
no,
that wrong.
You don't want to do that,
no.
No?
No.
Okay,
no.
Well, then I washed it all off with this high-pressure hose and got off as much of the scale as I could reach, because mm-hmm. someone else told me to do that. It's too late for this other spray. And so then I was told just before it blooms, like March maybe, pour into the soil some of this Bayer.
No.
Okay, tell me what you think.
All right.
Yeah, you know, all of those things can work if they're applied at an appropriate time, except don't use malathion. Our scale generally has one population a year. In a very long season, you might get two. But let me ask you this. Do you put any Christmas lights or anything in your tree?
Yes, I do.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. That actually will increase the amount of populations in magnolia scale that you see. per year, because that mm-hmm. heat from the lights creates a wonderful environment for them. And you have to know your enemy in this instance, and you have to understand the life cycle of that scale. And the best time to get rid of scale is when it's in the crawler stage. And so it does require you to watch to see what's going on with that tree, with that critter. And you've got about a 7 to 10 day period to nail it. When it's in the crawler stage, it is the most vulnerable in the early parts of the crawler stage, and you can actually hit it with horticultural oil and suffocate the little suckers at that point. Otherwise, once they are under their hard shell, they are really, really difficult to get taken care of. Now, the soil drenches will work if they're put down at an appropriate time and they are allowed to uptake, but a large tree, that's going to take a lot of product, and quite frankly, that would be like my last option, unless it's on its last legs. And Brian looks like
yeah,
he wants
no,
to
I
say
just
something.
Wanted to kind of define what we mean by the crawler stage.
Yes,
here.
Yes, please go
yeah,
ahead.
Yeah, so if you're looking at the scale that's on the branch, that's kind of the adult that's got a hard shell, and what you want to mm-hmm. do is kind of pop some of those off and watch for little itty bitty, and they're called crawlers because they crawl, but they'll be very tiny. They'll be under those shells, and when you start to see those active, that's when you need to start getting the oils on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Good point. That shell is very, very protective, and you can spray all you want, but it's not going to penetrate that outer shell.
Yeah, you want those crawlers to come
yes,
out, and then
yes.
you're going to hit them with the oil, and that's going to kill them because they're soft-bodied.
They're very soft-bodied, and then it doesn't take anything that tremendously invasive to get them taken care of.
Yeah.
It is just a matter of covering them, that soft body, and suffocating them with an appropriately weighted horticultural oil. But what I would do is actually take a picture or send a sample of it to Phil at the lab to get an appropriate ID on which one you're dealing with. You might even take it, I don't know if you've got an extension office, but you know, take it to your local extension office and see if they can ID it for you, or send it to Phil at the lab, or send Phil a picture. He's excellent with photos. And get an appropriate ID so that you get some sort of an idea of what the life cycle is, so you don't have to be out there 365 days of the year watching for crawlers. He can give you a real good range as to when you need to be watching for those little babies coming out.
And we have a great fact sheet on magnolia scale as well. So again, if you go to my website, go into publications and look under insects under magnolia scale, mm-hmm. you'll find it.
Yeah. And you know, as far as the lights go, if you continue to use the lights, I would just not have them on all the time and limit the amount of time that they are in the tree, because that increases the heat and it increases the populations.
Thanks, Joyce, for calling, and good luck. Pat in Washburn County, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I have a very mature white oak, and it is dropping whole clumps of leaves, a twig with 6 leaves on it. And I wondered if there's any...
Yeah, are the clumps of leaves, are those kind of spread across the entire canopy of the tree? Can you tell?
Yes. When I look up, right, there are... these brown clumps that are going to be on the ground tomorrow.
Yeah, some of that may have
scattered throughout.
Some of that may have started out as some drought stress on the tree. Mm-hmm. We've been seeing a lot of oaks where the tips and kind of randomly spread through the canopy of the tree. You'll have the tips of the branches turning brown. And those may be simply those branches are now dead and they're just getting blown off mm-hmm. as they weaken. Sometimes we will see, but it's usually oftentimes green leaves that we'll see coming down in clumps when we have a lot of squirrel activity
yeah.
around. So that's another possibility. But I think with brown leaves, I think just because of the drought we had this summer, a few of those branch tips are dying and those clumps are now coming out
mm-hmm.
of the tree.
Mm-hmm. So
nothing tremendous.
Water
the tree if you can. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be my recommendation.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Brian Huddleston and Liz Freemuth, our guest today, Larry Mueller here. Join in with your plant disease. We're zeroing in on plant diseases today. So if you've got a plant disease question, give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Ed in Appleton, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon to you all, and I really hope you can help me. I have like a three-part question. I have about a 50-year-old Macintosh apple tree. The fruit itself gets scabby, disfigured, and it has sort of a needle thin tracking through it. What I'd like to be able to do is to revitalize the tree. It's healthy except for the fruit itself. I had heard that you put wood ashes around the tree. It might be successful, but I'd like to look at some organic material and be able to get the tree in taken care of in good shape, please.
Yeah.
Okay, organic material, about the only thing out there, well, I'll tell you this, go to Atra, ATTRA website, and that will have some good organic recommendations, and they actually do follow the federal organic guidelines for what they recommend. But as far as products out there, you know, copper is acceptable, I do believe. Some of the sulfurs are, but also for covering, for basic fungicide and pesticide treatments that are necessary on many, many apples in order to get a good crop, there's not really a good organic alternative. One that has been used successfully, anecdotally, research is still out, is a clay, a kaolin clay that has a bit of a polymer in it. And you have to get that on almost as regularly as you would any fungicide or pesticide in order to get very, very good control, because that clay has to surround the leaves and the fruit all the time, basically. They do still photosynthesize wonderfully. They will produce great, and it's not that it prevents anything other than contact with diseases and insects, and that's where you get the control. But again, it's anecdotal. A lot of organic orchards are using it with, in their minds, great success, but that's about the only thing I can think of organically to use.
The other thing, it sounds like you've got a relatively old tree that probably needs some renovation.
Yeah.
And so what I would recommend would probably be some pruning, and I'm not an expert in this, but what I would suggest you do, if you go to our UW Extension Publications website, and that one is Learning Store. It's all one word, .uwex.edu. And just do a search on apples in the search line. And there's this wonderful multi-page publication called Growing Apples in Wisconsin.
Yeah, it's a great one. Yeah.
And that's one that I actually recommend that people actually buy that publication, because it's a really nice publication that talks about how to grow apples, how to maintain them, how to prune them, how to fertilize them, all these sorts of things, how to manage disease and insect pests. And they may not have exactly the sort of organic information that you need, but it's a good place to start for cultural methods for preventing particularly diseases and possibly some insect pests as well.
And I think the one characterization of what a tree should look like if it's producing fruit, it was given by a former fruit expert here on campus. And this is not me, and I like cats, but he said you should be able to throw a cat through the tree when you get done pruning, and it shouldn't be able to catch on any branches. So you're not looking for an aesthetically pleasing tree when you're pruning for production. You're looking for maximizing sunlight to all parts of that tree.
And airflow and
everything. And that, the cultural part of it, is huge in order to get anything to work. Whatever treatment plan you go with, in order to get anything to work, cultural has to be there first and foremost.
And get rid of any of the leaves that come down, any of the old fruits that are on the ground. Those need to be collected up, and you need to keep it clean around the base of that tree.
So did we hit all three?
That's excellent. That's very timely with that. One last question relates to, when's the best time to prune a tree? I'm sure that's on
dormant season. Dormant season. And so winter, it doesn't have to be a warm day, but, you know, other than for yourself, you know, pick a day that's halfway decent, but you don't want time when there's a lot of moisture in the air. Pick a sunny day. The cells will close off faster when you do that. And, you know, just pick a nice, warm, half-winter day to go out there and get it
January
done.
January thaw or February thaw. When
exactly.
It gets a little bit warmer, though, I think that's a great time to prune trees in general.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Ed. Thank you for calling. Terry in Cambria emailed in, is there blight or another reason that arborvitae are dying or at least turning brown all over central Wisconsin? I've watered mine religiously this summer, but they've all turned brown.
Yeah, I think there is a lot of drought stress related.
And heat stress.
Browning and heat stress.
Heat stress.
Yeah, you can water them a lot, but if it gets really hot, those tips of the branches will dehydrate. even though you're giving them a lot of water. So that may be part of it. Sometimes if it's an area where there are wetter conditions, then you can get root rots that'll set in that will limit water uptake, and that can lead to exactly the same sorts of symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
There are some needle blights that I see on occasion on arborvitae. But those usually are relatively cosmetic. But the only way to
figure
out...
They don't move as fast as what we've seen this year.
So really, to get a better sense, if you're really interested, get a sample in the clinic, including a root sample, and we can check for root rot organisms, and we can check to see if there is anything in the needles causing a problem.
Well, you know, it sounds so basic, but we have to remember, go out and do a scratch test, because because those needles or the leaves look brown and look dead, trees do have normal responses to shut down so that they're not expending internal energy on external issues that, you know, will take them out. So do a scratch test and see if there's some live tissue.
And now I'm trying to think like an entomologist, because all of a sudden it dawned on me that another thing would be mites.
Mites, yeah.
Well, in this kind of heat.
And it's been a great season for mites.
And in this heat, you know, that we've had dry heat, it's perfect for it in central and southern.
Lynn in Milwaukee. Hi, thanks for calling.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me. I have a maple tree in my front yard that last year and this year has black spots all over its leaves. It almost looks like somebody put out a cigarette.
Yeah.
It has that whole appearance.
We talked
How
about,
do I get rid of it?
We talked about this disease at the top of the hour, or top of the program, and this is a tar spot. And again, good fall cleanup for that. So make sure you're collecting up all of that leaf litter from that tree. Get it out of your yard. I would take it someplace that does kind of commercial composting. I would not keep that material around. And this is a pretty much a cosmetic disease. So if you can get good fall cleanup for a couple of years, I think you'll get most of this under control.
It'll break the cycle well.
Somebody was wondering.
Cut the tree down.
No, definitely not. No.
Not unless you want to.
Somebody was wondering if they see these little tar, look like tar spots on the sidewalks. Is that tar spot or is that?
No, it's probably, I'm thinking if those, and you sometimes get these on the siding of on houses, there's a little fungus called artillery fungus, and it sends out packets of spores, and they're very sticky. And they'll stick to sidewalks, they'll stick to walls, they'll stick to cars.
The tar spot on leaves, even the raised stuff that has a fingerprint look, it is on the, leaf.
It's on the leaf.
Yeah, so it doesn't come off.
All right. Well, we have Tad from Ontario, who the power company came through and trimmed some small branches from a century-old oak tree. I am worried that the stress from the drought might have weakened the tree, and even trimming the small branches might be doing it some harm. Should I be concerned? Well, you should be concerned, because nobody is supposed to be trimming an oak tree.
Well, it depends on when they trim.
When they trim. You know, if it was in general, I don't recommend trimming oaks in the summertime because of oak wilt.
It used to be April to August, and I don't look at anything from
dormant
end of February. Yeah, end of February through like the beginning of November.
Yeah.
Don't mess with them at this point. You know, it's just too iffy. And I've seen beetles out. The little tiny beetles have been out the end of February. So, yeah, you know, you really have to pay attention to that kind of thing. Should you be concerned? Maybe. But what
not
are you
so
gonna,
much from just the pruning, not, the loss of the branches. It's more whether there was transmission of the oak wilt fungus.
Exactly. And I do have to say that oftentimes the power company does do a very good job of pruning. So hopefully this was one that did do a very good job of pruning. Water, nutrients after hard frost.
And hopefully they were cleaning tools between sites as well, or between trees, because you can move in some pathogens on pruning tools.
I've seen way too much where that hasn't happened.
You might, since I was a member of the Dane County Tree Board for so many years, you should get a hold of the power company. I would contact them and say, you prune these oaks, and you should not be pruning oaks. And essentially, March through
October
for sure.
Yep.
Because they're doing nothing but potentially spreading oak wilt.
And I'm assuming this is Ontario, Wisconsin, not Ontario, Canada. Because,
Never know. I don't think Ontario, Canada had much drought this year, did they? Yeah. No, it didn't look. But,
So Tad, for sure, as our guests were recommending, make sure you water and keep it as healthy as you can.
You know, and sometimes it is the simple stuff. You know, we talk about cultural, which tends to be a little bit more on the simple side, but timing is appropriate, water, nutrients, things like that, you know, that goes an awfully long way.
Yeah. Reducing stress.
Well, my stress has been pretty low through this whole show. It's been a lot of fun. And no black spots have come out on me or anything. Oh, thank you guys so much. And I hope you'll come back and be with us again.
Anytime. Love it.
Liz Freemuth, previously horticulturist for Walworth County, now owner of The Garden Hole. She has a passion for healthy plants. By the way, her website is www.thegardenhole.com, And I certainly invite you. We've got a – actually, we have a link to it on my Facebook page.
Oh, wonderful. Wonderful.
So click on there to the Larry Mueller Show. You can click right to it. And also, I think we've got Brian's Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic up there somewhere, too. Brian Direct is director of the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic at the UW-Madison Department of Plant Pathology. And, of course, they will be back, and we will talk with them again. Just looking ahead, Monday, Labor Day, I'll be here. Hope you'll be listening, and we'll be talking about birds, as we always do on holidays, with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.